Hello, MarTechers. It's Keanu here, researcher at the MarTech Weekly, and today we have a special treat for you. As part of the Making Sense of MarTech podcast, we are kicking off a new monthly series of MarTech case studies, which will be long-form episodes which delve into details of the most interesting stories in MarTech. First up, we have Satya Ramachandran from Rappi, which is a Latin American super app that connects buyers with vendors and delivery drivers to bring a wide range of goods directly to your door. Rappi's massive reliance on deep linking led the company to using computer vision and robots to QA whether consumers clicking on ads were successfully landing where they should have in the app. With that, I'll hand over to Juan.
We are talking about scaling marketing, MarTech QA, and using exciting new tools to enable the scaling and the deployment of a lot of experimentation and deep linking and experiences without having this huge QA overhead of manual staff doing that work. And so I'm really excited for this one. Now, I'm introducing Satya. So Satya, I'd love to for us to kick off. I mean, what did brought you to working at Rappi? I mean, what was a challenge and the opportunity that got you excited working with such an interesting company targeting Latin America?
Absolutely. So I joined Rappi from DoorDash, and I've been in the MarTech space for the past 12 years. Before that, I was doing distributed databases. So I was building distributed databases. And what got me into MarTech was the fact that it had like that. Whereas when I was building databases, I was just like having people build applications on top. But I didn't understand the impact it had for the business, right? Like not a direct impact. And when I started getting into MarTech, I was affecting marketing and I could like see how the dollars are spent efficiently and so on. So that was great. That was my first introduction into an application. So I was in MarTech for some time. And then I worked at a brand at Newstar first. Then I worked for a publisher, an out-of-home publisher, like, you know, called Firefly. But finally, I had to come to a brand. I really wanted to see how marketing was done. And so DoorDash was my first introduction of working at a brand.
Yep.
Fairly mature. That DoorDash was a fairly mature company, and I learned a lot. But Rappi was like growing, and that was like the most more exciting challenge. So now, like the reason why like Rappi is interesting is it's a brand. It's got it's obviously got all of the like I get visibility into how brand kind of looks at marketing, but more importantly, it's in that like you know hyper growth phase. So I'm part of a brand which is growing at a hyper growth phase, and building technology for a company like that is always exciting.
Exciting. So was Rappi your shift into MarTech specifically, going from a tech background to more marketing technologies? Was that
DoorDash was my first into the MarTech space.
Oh, okay.
But yeah. Rappi was kind of like, you know, something which was like, Rappi was where it kind of like accelerated that whole, like, you know, scope accelerated at Rappi.
It sounds like it was like more green field in a way, in that you probably had like less infrastructure, but more opportunity to kind of influence that and build that infrastructure in the business. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, for sure. At Rappi, especially in LATAM, there's a lot more opportunities to kind of like deploy these sophisticated technologies.
That's fantastic.
Question about it.
And what is your role? How would you describe your day-to-day work?
So I head AdTech and MarTech at Rappi. So I'm responsible for all of the technology initiatives that is powering growth. And this is a platform. Right now, the platform that I'm building is, I'm calling it Acquisition IQ. It's focused on acquisition. And it's specifically focused on getting consumers to that. As you know, Rappi is like a three-sided business. It's got like consumers who basically use the Rappi app to make, like, you know, to make orders to deliver for it. It's a delivery based app, so to get orders for delivery. And then you have drivers who basically deliver the app. And then you have merchants who would actually go and who have the products, right? So you kind of buy it from the merchant. So it's a three-sided marketplace. Right now, my focus is mostly on the consumer side of things, technology, which is powering growth for the consumer side.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because like, I guess you could say that that with three-sided marketplaces are perhaps some of the hardest business models to crack for like to make them
100%.
profitable. And they've got the cold start problem. They've got the supply demand, which is always having to be tweaked. You've got very thin margins because, you know, the driver needs to take a cut. Obviously, the merchant wants majority of revenues. You have to negotiate with all the merchants. And then the customer wants the best price as well, right? And so it's a very hard business to do right. But with the right marketing technology, user acquisition, but then also the loyalty retention, and then, of course, the upselling and the ability to drive users back to the app to continue to transact is like a really high leverage amount of work for marketing technology, right? Like for example, just e-commerce as an example, it's of course marketing technology is so incredibly important. However, it's not as central in terms of leverage, right? Like you can deploy an amazing personalization use case and it could drive an incredible amount of value purely by virtue of you've got three parties to work with, three different parties within a business to keep happy, and you have to constantly tweak those. So I can imagine you now like working at DoorDash and then now at Rappi that you've kind of seen the power of marketing technology in these types of marketplace businesses. But I'd love to hear in your words, I mean, what has been your experience of seeing, I guess, the importance and the impact of deploying really interesting marketing technology programs, use cases, concepts, into these types of businesses?
So first thing first, right? Like to your point, the three-sided marketplace, that's definitely a challenge. Now, of course, you talked about the business challenges. The MarTech challenges, it's actually three different categories of business in one company, right? So you have B2C, which is how your consumer is. Like that's like, you know, when you're looking at the consumer business, it's actually a B2C business. Then when you look at the drivers are not consumers. They are like small businesses, right? Like it's kind of B2B, but it's like a very small and medium business. And then when you look at the merchant side, it's actually B2B, but it's like enterprise businesses. So the marketing, when you are kind of doing it across all of these different segments, have a completely different notion associated. There's a completely different notion, right? And so the MarTech itself is like very different. And once I feel if you kind of built a MarTech for this, you pretty much built like MarTech for almost every known space in the thing. So that is one challenge, in my opinion.
That's incredible. It's fascinating to think about because those are three businesses in one from a MarTech perspective, right? Like
Correct.
software you use for consumers is very different from, for example, B2B pipeline. You
Correct.
know, like it's like totally different MarTech stack. So how do you think about that in terms of like the orchestrating a stack where you don't have different email marketing platforms or CDPs or different technologies or all in different boxes for different types of groups of customers? How do you grapple with that? Because that seems really complicated.
That is it is complicated and it's kind of a hard problem, but the way we are like we think about it is in like three separate realms, right? First, measurement. Measurement is kind of like, you know, obviously it's kind of like when you look at measurement for a B2C versus B2B versus B2B, which is an enterprise, the measurement is different, not because like, you know, the methodologies are different. It's just the channels that you use to basically reach customers across all of these are very different, right? The B2C is like a mostly paid marketing. You kind of like try to kind of like have digital, and that's kind of how you do it because it's like a massive, like you're reaching a massive market. Whereas like, you know, if you look at a B2B like driver, like the SMBs or B2B merchants, the channels that you reach are slightly different, right? Like, you know, it's like more like, you know, offline first. On the second two, that's first. And then the second thing is like, you know, promotions, like trade shows and events are like a lot more important. Not to say that B2C is not important. So the kind of channels that you reach is very important. Therefore, when you look at measurement, the measurement becomes like a lot more of these media mix models and how media mix models are actually going to use measurement becomes very important. That's last two in the B2B space, right? Whereas in the B2C space, because it's addressable, most of this paid media is addressable, like you can use all of the later digital technologies that are available for measurement. And then same thing in terms of like, you know, your creatives, how you kind of like create those smart, like your creative program. Again, it's like a lot more like digital creatives in terms of like, you know, how you kind of do it in the first one. The second one is like much more like, you know, agencies and how you kind of like agency provided creators. Whereas a lot of creators internal, it's like, you know, a lot of creators that is getting in-house, right? In B2C, in digital, it's like you have a large creative team and they can basically come up with a lot of creators and so on. And from a tooling perspective, a lot of owned media in both cases, like in our B2C space, once we acquire a customer, as soon as the customer is inside the door, then we use owned media for actually most of the marketing, right? But if you really look at B2B and especially the enterprise case and so on and so forth, similar, right? We kind of obtain lists. It's like our direct sales force, which basically goes and like talks to them, and then there's like much more like email and so on. Those are the channels that we reach.
It's really interesting because I can imagine for a business like Rappi, you have priorities for all three, right? And different things you want to deploy. And is it directed by where is the focus in terms of the volume of users or the growth for each? So for example, you know, would it be like, okay, in quarter one, from a MarTech perspective, we're building use cases for merchants because we need to drive more merchants to come onto the platform because we've lost a few, you know, as an example. Or, you know, and then vice versa. Is it like, oh, quarter one, we're looking at consumers because we're looking to drive consumer growth? Or is it like, because I'm thinking like, given that you're sort of overseeing the other marketing technology, advertising technology stack, how do you prioritize all that stuff? Because it's fascinating to me thinking the business would have different priorities throughout the year or through different seasons based on who they need to bring in to drive growth on either side of the marketplace.
So prioritization is a problem because the MarTech resourcing has always been like, you know, I mean, yes. It's like the resourcing for MarTech is always like an afterthought, right? Like that's something that I think we've all of us find as an issue. So forget about this, like prioritization in general is a problem for MarTech. Here it becomes a lot more challenging. The way we like, you know, I think it's just to your point, Juan, it's exactly that, right? It's basically like, you know, like what the business priorities are. Our business priorities have been B2C or the consumers are like the fourth. So that always receives the lion's share of our thing. And then reaching out to merchants is like the second like big share like that we actually go and get, right? But then the thing is, of course, like we do kind of like support the drivers. That seems to be like how it kind of the cookie crumbles, right? As we go along, it is defined by the business priority. Every year we have like a plan that like every year we have an annual plan and we come up with a list of annual priorities of what is there for the business, and then we have a quarterly plan, and based on the plan then we come up with like a few priorities across all of these businesses, and then we go and arrange our resourcing according to it. But most of the time, like the lion's share is basically consumers. Our focus on the tech is.
Yeah, because I can imagine if you can solve the consumer problem and all the other problems become lesser, I can imagine. Like, because you've got a better value proposition for merchants and you've got more revenue creation, income creation opportunity for drivers, right? So because
100%.
Rappi is a business that's already solved the cold start. When you start a marketplace, what do you focus on first? You bring consumers on, there's nothing there. You bring merchants on, there's no customers. You know, you bring the drivers or the fulfillers, and those folks have got nothing to do. They're just sitting in their cars, right? So like, you guys are beyond that now, but it sounds like as the marketplace grows and matures, the consumer base becomes probably the greater priority just because it solves so many problems for the B2B side of the marketplace, which is the merchants and drivers. So it's an interesting to think about, isn't it? Because I guess the importance of acquisition, retention, as you say, onboarding, all of those things are actually a very high priority for Rappi, like very central to how Rappi works as a business.
Yes, I mean, it is interesting. One more, I just want to, like on a previous point, I just want to bring one more thing. Direct sales, right? Like, if you look at the B2B businesses, they have a direct sales, like some kind of direct sales, kind of, which in B2C, you just don't have it. You cannot, right? Yeah. You would not be able to have it, which is why the importance of marketing and then then the associated tech becomes the scaling of marketing becomes a lot more important. But I agree with you on the rest of the points. It's kind of like the cold start problem is done. The business is up and running, and now it's all about the growth in consumers. Here, I just want to talk about one thing from a Rappi point of view, and this is true for a lot of companies. Back in the this so Rappi is a delivery business, and it's like, you know, we deliver from restaurants, we deliver from CPGs and so on. These kind of businesses became really, really good during the COVID era, like, you know, when everybody was locked in, and so these businesses grew. And so the general approach was to grow, right? Like, it was just grow at any cost. That was the approach in that time. But then, like, as soon as the COVID stopped, and for the past year or two, that became a challenge, right? Like, you know, investment to basically grow became a challenge.
Yeah.
And so folks are looking at profitability. So now the big focus of our marketing tech is growth, but finding profitable customers, like acquiring customers who have a high chance of retention. And that is a huge focus for this, for Rappi. And that is something that we've been focused on for the past year, right? And we've kind of built technology. Yeah. And I find that increasingly, it's not just going and acquiring any customer. It's finding the right customer has become a more important problem to solve.
So finding the right customer.
Yeah.
Isn't it? Because you're right that, like, there's always going to be particularly when you're doing large scale acquisition programs, like, there's always going to be quite a bit of churn. So I can imagine you guys are like, okay, well, you know, instead of just like, oh, we drove X amount of signups per month, it's like, well, what's been the tail end of that? How many of those churned? How many of those deleted the app? How many of those, you know, actually stopped spending, you know? And so that having that balance, it's always, do you split it out by, you have folks working on acquisition and then folks working on retention and the churn?
Yes.
And I imagine that as a business, you'd have to bring those two folks together, right? To solve that profitability
yes.
equation.
The technology basically is like a common platform that is running on top of it. So the measurement and all of the modeling that is involved in, like, which is sitting on top of measurement, which is providing those insights and the various technologies that are involved, right? Obviously, like, when you want to basically go and reach customers for retention, we use Braze for our push notifications and so on. So that technology is on Braze, but you've got other technologies when you're reaching paid marketing, like, you know, Google, TikTok, and Facebook. But the underlying data and machine learning are all, like, common across all of these different life cycles.
So we've understood a little bit about Rappi as a business, how it works from a MarTech perspective, which is absolutely fascinating. And a little bit about your work as well and what brought you to Rappi and your work in ad tech and MarTech. But I want to kind of switch gears now into a demo that you showed me, which was a couple months ago or a month ago, which was around this concept of deep linking and the UX and the consumer journey flows from web to app. And how do you get users more effectively into your app quicker from the point of having to download the app from an app store, from a user that already has the app that deep links them into a product page or a specific experience within the app. Now, give me a view on, because you've done a lot of work to solve some of the testing and the QA and things like that around deep linking scenarios. But what's your view on the current challenges around the UX and the experience of deep linking from web to app?
Yeah, so I'll tell you what we went through, and I think it's a very common story in marketing, right? First of all, paid marketing, especially like digital marketing, these are all very quantitative folks. They look at data, they look at CAC, they look at conversion rates, and they're, like, you know, deeply involved in all these analytics. And so what would happen is the analytics would drop, like, they would look at all these numbers, the analytics would drop, and then, like, some conversion rate would drop, or the click, like, you know, the number of clicks would be lower, or the something would happen. And then you would start looking at it, and you'll start peeling the onion, and then seeing, okay, where is the problem? Is the problem in the campaign and so on? Is a problem in the campaign setup, or, like, whatever? More often than not, what we found out was, it is when there is a handoff between the campaign, when somebody's clicking on the ad, and then, like, you know, landing on our app, and then it just doesn't land in the place it's supposed to. It either just lands, like, supposed to land in a product page, it lands in a, like, just in a home page, or it is basically, like, you know, user gets an error, like a blank page, and so on and so forth, right? And these are things which are not monitored, because it's coming from, like, a Google like it's coming from the Google space into the Rappi space. Right? Consider it like that. The user is being transported from one space to another. And this we were never able to quantify it. There is a, you just find some conversion rate errors, but you were never able to quantify how much of that is basically a software. And we really did not have like a QA person who's basically QAing all of our workflows. Just to kind of give you an idea, we have about 150 different type of workflows across all of our marketing campaigns, right? And these workflows are like, you know, they've been built over a period of time, like, you know, a couple of years. And what would happen is you would probably test it once to kind of like when you're building that workflow. And then after that, you would never test it. An example of that is, let's say you go to paid search and you're searching for like a brand, right? And then you are clicking on a link. Then it lands into an app, right? You've installed an app. Via a deep link, it lands into your app. You are supposed to get to that brand page. Like you're supposed to, let's say I click on McDonald's, I search for McDonald's and you land into the Rappi page. You're supposed to go into a McDonald's brand page, which has got all like, you know, all their products displayed and so on, right? If I basically click, like, and that's my intended user experience. Now, if I click, if I search for McDonald's, okay, and then I saw a Rappi ad, I clicked on it, and I just, like, land on the homepage, or worse, I get an error, that conversion is lost. And this keeps happening all the time, right? If you have an app installed, because these are all predominantly an app thing, right? Like, most of our, so it'll deep link into an app. Now, that's... Like, of course, like the same problems exist in a web, but I want to talk in terms of the app context. So there, what happens is there are two different types of experiences that you would have. Let's say you don't have an app. Then what would happen is you'd get directed to the app store. You would have the user install the app, register. And then once I'm registered, the intended experience is after the registration, the first thing I need to do is to go to that branded page, whatever I want to do, right? And then if I do have that, then I land on the branded page. Irrespective, my final destination needs to be there, right? That space, that's when I have the maximum conversion rates.
So they click on the search listing and then there's a decisioning, right? Who do you use for your deep linking? Do you use something like Branch or?
So we use OneLink by AppsFlare. Sorry.
Oh, okay, cool.
AppsFlare. And then we also had Branch, and we used to basically have Branch on the thing, but now like we are all consolidated on AppsFlare.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, cool. AppsFlare, I've only used them once,
and it's OneLink.
OneLink. So it's OneLink, but then it makes a decision, right? Okay, do they have the app? Yes, they go straight into the app screen if they have the app already, or if they need, you know, there's like a subroutine there around, do they need to download the app? So they have to go. I'm not sure. Do you guys, when you do app downloads, is it the user can't use the app until they download the update? Or is it that it just, they can update it whenever, you know, sometimes I'll open up apps like Uber. It's like, oh, you have to update the app. And so yes, they go deep link straight in the app and then they go to the app store, they download the app, they open the app, and then it takes them to the app screen basically.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
Irrespective, that should be your user experience. And then that's your maximum conversion rate, right? So the problem happens, the problem that happens now is the fact that, like, you know, so everything after you open the app, the product tests it reasonably well. What you have, like the open the app, right? Mm. Or like, you know, I basically come in and I log in to Rappi.
Yeah.
And I like those are well tested.
Yeah.
What the product never tests is this thing where the original interaction happens outside Rappi, right? And then I'm like coming deep into that. I'm not following the whole login to the Rappi app or like, you know, and so on. I'm just opening the app and then I'm directly jumping to a page.
Yeah.
That deep link is never tested.
Oh, really? So so not tested.
Because this is a deep link, right? Like in the sense that this link is coming from outside the app. It's not originating inside the thing. And so these are seldom tested by companies. And
Really?
marketing is one of the biggest consumers for it.
So what does the testing look like? So are you saying that so there's a deep so this apps via link and they have the app, yes, they're deep linked straight into an app screen. And then you're saying that handover, there's like a gap in analytics, like between
Correct.
because I guess
I mean,
you're saying,
analytics is there. Analytics is there. It will just say that whether I clicked on the link. See, analytics, what will it will say whether I clicked on the link and I landed on Rappi page. But exactly what happened after that, like, you know, all you would know is, okay, I landed on the app, whether I made an order or like what I like other analytics following that when you land, that is not present and nobody looks at it, right? Nobody kind of understands why people are landing and where they are landing and so on and so forth. And that's not tested. You probably, when you create the one link,
So
when
you
you create the one
only
link, you'll test it once and that's it. You
so
never test it all the time.
that's interesting. So you only know that a user clicked the link, right?
Click the link
But
and
then
landed it in your
yeah,
app.
and landed in the app, but doesn't tell you where. Like where
Correct.
they landed. The screen name, I'm assuming, I don't know, apps use Firebase. There's a pretty common analytics package for web,
Correct.
or if you're using Adobe,
Correct.
there's a web kit, whatever. But
Correct.
yeah,
Correct.
so I had this problem with several enterprise brands where we were doing these things to deep link into apps, and we found that we just totally lose the rest of the journey as soon as they're in here. We kind of lose that
Correct.
because it says crossover. We can't attribute it back to the, to the like all our behaviors can't be attributed back from this, which is the if we're doing paid Google search or Facebook ads or whatever, you can't like there's a missing piece there where you're like, oh, you know, and that's just kind of this is getting just to the bigger point, which is actually pretty interesting to say, well, to know what a user does after they land in the app, is critical for retention, right? Like what their first interactions are, right? So they click on something, and then do we know if how they interacted? You know, we do we know, well, it was the paid search listing relevant to the deep link? Was it the right ad? You know, and but that's an acquisition and retention. So I can see now why the focus on building, I'm assuming that this is all building your testing practice is in here. Because you want
Correct.
to get a sense of like, okay, if we start experimenting, then we get a sense of, yes, of course, the impact on acquisition and getting users into the app and registering in the app, but then also the impact of what they do after they're in the app and they start using the products and services. So I could see how like the deep link into the app is so absolutely critical, and you would never normally just, you just think, oh, you know, this is something a business does is deep link, it's like, you know, whatever, right? Like this is a practical part of the business, but actually it sounds like this is a really important strategic area for the business to drive growth, and to retain
Correct.
their customers. Yeah, so
Correct.
very interesting, mate. Did you have any comments on that? Because I'm just sort of feeding back what I'm hearing and thinking. But just wanted to make sure I'm on the right track in terms of how you're thinking about this business
No.
problem.
No, absolutely. And that's kind of the big challenge, right? Like, and we are kind of like people look at, oh, whether Facebook is really incremental, whether the creative work and so on and so forth. But there are some low-hanging fruits where everything works. It's just that, like, you know, you have bugs in these workflows and nobody's kind of testing these workflows. And like, you know, that, like, the insight into that and like constantly testing these workflows and making sure these workflows are working as intended, right? That itself will give you a lot more thing, right? Like, people are always analyzing like larger problems. And I feel like this is like really basic. Like you have these workflows that you're supposed to implement, are all these workflows working as intended?
Very interesting. 'Cause yeah, you're right that like it's a problem that's very ignorable, you know.
Yeah.
Like for example, user registration on Rappi would probably be a bigger thing that people would want to experiment on when it comes to acquisition, right? It's like, you know, make it easier, make it simpler, drive, motivate people to actually register. Whereas like this whole thing here is not necessarily, well, the whole concept of building a experimentation program just to make sure everything's functioning as it should when it comes to the link deep link handover just seems like Oh, that's boring. Do you know what I mean? It's not the sexy experimentation that you tend to see, but it's also it's sort of explaining and mapping this out to the business problems and where you're going as a business. You can see how absolutely critical that handover is, and you really need to nail that for every single customer and every workflow. So yeah, it is interesting that it's not the sexier
So
problem, but it's more impactful.
one problem one is like I think the straightforward bugs are easy, right? Like, so if I land on that page, every time I get an error, like some parameter is not passed, and therefore I'm not reading the parameter that has been passed from page search, and therefore I'm not basically like rendering the page right. These are caught usually. What we found was 60% of the errors that basically comes in are temporary. That is, when you run it like 5 times, it'll fail 2 times. 3 times it'll actually work. And these are timing problems. Like, I don't know, like your server is overloaded, or whatever it is, right? Like, there are like lots of other aspects where, like, the for some reason there's a timing problem, and the error happens only like a few times. See, that those are the things that I think what happens is, if you really don't test this reasonably well, what would happen is you would lose them, and you'd never catch it, right? You're kind of looking at somewhere else, but you'd never catch it unless until you're kind of periodically going and running through all of these things and like testing it all the time. There's no way you would catch those kind of temporary errors. And in our experience, that is 60% of errors that actually happens are these temporary workflows.
Isn't it? Because you'd say, yeah, it's a timing error. But then, yeah, if you've got, if we're looking at the scale of something, similar to DoorDash or Rappi, where you've got tens of thousands, sometimes hundreds of thousands of customers deep linking into stuff, potentially, depending on your paid media campaigns and whatnot. But how are you able to actually experiment and make sure that they will work as intended? It's actually almost an impossible problem to do manually. But it's also, as you say, to get insight and analytics into that, the only way to get insight into errors is to continually run experiment testing, right? Is to continually test. How else are we going to continually test?
So this is the problem that happens, right? Like, imagine, so marketing typically, like I was a developer, and I'm sure like a lot of them have the same, but I was a like a distributed systems developer, and then I moved into marketing, right? So I have experience on both sides of the aisle, but I can imagine a conversation here. So folks come back and say, you know what, the link is failing. So immediately the engineer would say, can you give me a reproducible test case? Can you basically go show? By definition, these things are not reproducible. Like, can you, because you say, if you don't give people, right? So a developer, this is a standard reaction for a developer, right? Oh, can you tell me a reproducible test case? Can you kind of show me the error, like, or record a video of that error happening or something like that? But it's a timing issue. The way it would not happen is, like, obviously when I run it, by definition, they would actually work. And so that's another disadvantage, like, all these marketing folks, and they're not like deeply technical enough, and usually the engineer kind of gets his way on it. That's another reason why these things are
That's really interesting, because you're right that like most errors or most issues that come up, if there's like a bug in the JavaScript and it's like we can reproduce it many times over on a website page or in an app, it's just an issue with the actual code base that can be changed. But with deep linking, you're saying that the timing issue is not reproducible because it's based on the error can come through based on the specific timing in which a user clicked on a link. But could you expand on the timing bit for me to understand that? How does that work? Is it because the website app is not up to date with what's in the deep links? Is there a misalignment with campaigns, with the links you're sending out and the what's actually deployed on the app? Or is it a time of day thing? Like, what do you mean by timing?
So sometimes what happens is, let's say, like, for some reason the server is loaded, and at that time, like, it's like, either it's got like, memory issues or like some kind of like disk issues and so on and so forth, and the server is like dropping requests, right? Like, those are like temporary issues. Those are also like sometimes you can actually go and catch it. But there are bugs in the code. Like what happens is, like in our case, what so when you have a paid search campaign, those parameters are obviously preserved and they are patched in for measurement purposes, right? Like when all of these, like, you know, parameters have to kind of be passed in from paid search to app, and then they're recorded and they're passed in. So what we found out was, for some reason, there is a web server, there is a program within the web server which is actually taking those parameters and then like passing it on to the app and like for storing it and so on, right?
Yeah.
It was basically dropping those parameters one in seven times.
Oh, wow.
For some random reason, it was just dropping that in seven times. There was obviously a programming bug that was there, which was basically going and dropping it. So, but six or like it was most of the time it was passing, but sometimes it would just drop it and not send the parameters. So that click was not recorded in the app, right? And so so here actually the user's experience was okay, but we didn't even know that the user actually went through the whole thing. So our measurement was not recording it, which means that our conversion rates were lower and our click rates are lower and so on and so forth. So typically it's programming bugs that happen. There are complex workflows that are sitting behind the app, and there are some bugs which basically trigger only at certain point of time, and they are not triggering all the time. And those are the problems that are harder to find than something which happens 100% of the time. Those bugs, you normally figure it out, right? Mm-hmm. And these bugs which basically happen once in a while are the reason why you'll have to kind of take these workflows and not just it once, keep testing them over and over again so that you'll definitely be able to catch those bugs.
Yeah, that's awesome. And that's the thing. It's like how understanding the mechanics of how those links are populated and how they relate back to the actual specific locations of pages is a problem that can become unwieldy very quickly, right? Like it's very hard. It's very easy for that to just run away because you've got so many workflows happening at the same time. You've got so many campaigns. And so the problem can just get so big so quickly. And so we'll talk about the solution in our next call, of course, like thinking through like how you actually addressed it. But I want to talk a little bit about, okay, identifying the problem space, a technical problem, the lack of insight. How has that impacted the business? So, you know, thinking through like, what does that like prevented you from doing it? You know, and what is sort of, yeah, what has that led to?
The primary thing is lack of conversion. So what has happened is basically, obviously, marketing is about driving conversions and driving, like, you know, whatever metric that we are trying to do, either installs or like. So that obviously what is happening is, like, because of these errors, you get these conversion rates drop, and it's a silent drop. Like you don't even know why they're dropping. A lot of these times you don't even know why they're dropping, because it's not. Like I said, all these temporary errors, it's not happening all the time. So you don't realize that there is some problem and that's basically causing the loss of conversion. Usually you kind of like go and start looking at the creators or start looking at like something else, which has got nothing to do with anything, right? Like that is the biggest impact. I really think that there are other problems with this, right? Like in the sense that, like, you know, if you look at esoteric problems, brand imaging, right? Like imagine, like this is basically how I kind of described it to an exec. I spent all this time, I created an amazing marketing campaign, and this user was never exposed to Rappi. He kind of saw the marketing campaign, exposed to it. He came into the app and like he landed into Ether. So that user is never coming back to your app, right? Because by definition, I'm getting them the first time experience is really, really bad. And that's why I really think that problems in this, especially on user experience, is a lot worse than like even like, you know, user experience problems inside the product, where you have established users who are coming in and they're experiencing it. I'm not saying that's the problem, but this is basically users who have never experienced it. The app, and if their first experience is bad, then it really sucks.
You know, it's the front door. If the front door doesn't go anywhere, then there's nothing there, right? You know, if you walk into
100%.
A room and there's nothing in that room when there should be products, then, you know, you just walk straight out. And the experience of a user is like, yeah, well, there's nothing here. Okay, move on to the next thing. You know, let's go to DoorDash or let's go to another app, you know. So, you know, it's interesting,
Absolutely.
like thinking through how that has actually a pretty visceral impact on the user and not getting it right. And as you say, it's a silent problem, right? Like it has been
See,
historically, yeah.
that's what it is. And I might be biased because
Yeah.
like I've been part of marketing. There's a lot of thought process which goes into, okay, let me kind of present this offer in front of the user. Let
Yep.
me kind of like make sure like I get this experience so that I can get that user inside the door, right? And then when it fails, this is what I like, you know, the diagnosis is always about that experience, or maybe I didn't, my model is incorrect. The maybe I should have put 40% instead of 20%, and that's why the user did not convert. Like 9 out of 10 times, that seems to be the diagnosis. It's never the diagnosis, like, you know, maybe the thing is there because you don't have the technology to investigate, right? Marketing never basically goes and looks at the specific problem. They always kind of look at, like, you know, is their modeling wrong, measurement wrong, is their creatives wrong, and so on and so forth.
I'm curious because the company was having a conversion problem. There was a convert. There's a problem with there. Obviously, you know, there's a challenge around that. And you found that there was a problem. You isolated the problem to, okay, well, one of the biggest drop-offs is the web to app handover. But how did you actually find out that it was this timing error, but in the deep links? Like, what was that process? To think about, like, how did you actually find that problem? Because that's not super obvious to me. But that's
No,
just,
it's not obvious at all.
yeah,
So
yeah.
basically, first, we started experiencing these problems. We started manually testing it. That was like, you know, how, and then it was just not possible, right? Like we just did not have the hours of the day, and we couldn't go to work where we could test all these workflows. That's when we contacted this company, which is an automation company, which basically runs this QA test in like using computer vision and robotics to basically automate all the UX tests. So when we started running it at scale, that's when we started discovering these problems, right? See, if I run it by hand and when I basically go do it, obviously I don't see those errors and so on. But when you start running 500 workflows on a daily basis, and then you kind of like run that on a loop or something like that, right? Like what happens is eventually you kind of like get that. So there is this, you know, like it was like a process. It was like a thing where manual testing, we found some errors, then we started going to automation, and then for automation we started discovering real problems, which I feel like all these silent problems are real problems.
Okay, so it was you started looking going into the weeds of like doing the testing workflows as a business and then realizing pretty quickly that there's hundreds of these and there's no way we can do it manually or have a team member to do this testing for us. And I'm assuming because of the temporal nature of the errors, you had to run this testing every single day.
Correct. Every single day, different parts of the day, different times of the day, and so on and so forth. And you have to kind of like try to basically go and switch the timing around and so on, just to kind of like do it. It is still kind of like some kind of like a esoteric rule that we have. Like we run on Mondays in the morning, Tuesdays in the but literally we can actually go and like with this capability, we can actually go and like, you know, completely simulate a random user behavior, right, across all of these workflows.
But I do have one last question, which is, you know, why is testing such a bottleneck in this domain, right? Of apps and websites and UX. You know, why is it such a, because I feel as though, you know, with any experience that you launch, any sort of new campaign, the thing that is absolutely necessary is testing and QA. However, it can be a bottleneck, right? Because of the manual work. But what's your view? Like,
Correct.
what's your experience around the
But
testing
so
component?
that's the problem, right? From a testing point of view, because first of all, this is a complex workflow. You have to kind of like launch a paid social ad. Like you have to launch a Facebook video ad, then you have to click on it, then land on the app, then make an order, right? Like you have to go through all of these flows, and you have to kind of like run through at least a 15 or 20 step process to make sure that okay, everything is kind of working fine, right? And then different variations. Normally, like it's hard for a team which has a dedicated QA team But remember, marketing does not have a dedicated QA team. It just doesn't. It doesn't have a development team. I mean, it has a development team, but it's got a very small development team for like mostly like full stack developers who are like, you know, who are already stressed. Operators, right? Marketing operators who kind of are much better in like campaign operations, running campaigns, understanding like, you know, how digital media works and so on and so forth, but not necessarily folks who can actually go and like, you know, run through these workflows. And then more importantly, be testing them, right? And so on. So that's the problem. There is no dedicated QA. And then the resources are very, very low for MarTech.
This is actually a very interesting point you raise, because, you know, there's a lot of QA and testing is, as you say, in the domain of actual developers, right? And engineering. And so they do all their testing, but they're building a specific app or a specific thing, it's very isolated in terms of, like, you're literally, okay, we're doing a new website page. We need to QA the website page, you know, and that's it, right? And they QA the website page and then they get to all the ticks. But it's very isolated, just to one page or one app screen, you know. Whereas in marketing technology, by nature of the work, is that you're working with multiple platforms, right? So as you say, there's a long string of things that need to go. Everything needs to go right for the experience to go right.
100%.
So you could have like three touch points, three different apps, you know, and technology that sits in the middle of those apps, like with the deep linking. All of that needs to go right. And maybe 100%. That's an interesting way of thinking, is like, actually, maybe there's a rethink there around marketing technology QA, is that we just don't have that. It's very sophisticated type of QA across multiple platforms and apps. You have to be familiar and being able to write a test case, knowing what you need to look out for each one. So yeah, I can see what you're saying, is that it's the complexity in that means that it's very hard to find QA people that even know what to do, because so many of them are used to just QA the one thing and move on to the next thing, not the whole actual chain of experience. So it's very
correct. The product QA is all about like, you know, like product outcomes, right? Like, am I able to do the product? Where the marketing is a very different way of looking at it. I come into the ad, I need to kind of like come via the ad, and I need to do a specific action. That's one. The second thing is, from a product point of view, the origin is always I log in.
Yeah.
I mean, there might be some use cases where not logged in user for an app, it's very rare. Mm. Yeah. Website is different, right? That's why I wanted to keep website. You can reach for an app. Typically, if you just open an app, you have to log in. You have to log in, and that's your origin point. And then you kind of follow everything else, right?
Yeah.
But in marketing, what happens is it lands you somewhere in that, like that. It will land you deep in the app somewhere, like a corridor page, like a branding page, like a product specific product. Or it'll land right directly into your cart page with, like, you know, you right now you have like these apps, which basically you can like load everything, load your cart and directly land into your cart page and you'll just check out, right? Mm-hmm. So the point is your landing zones are like very, very specific from outside, inside the app. And those are workflows that while the product team develops it, they don't think about instituting test cases to basically go and test it, because they just cannot, like, they don't understand all the sources
that actually come from it, which is the marketing technologist is probably the only person in a business that has that holistic picture of all the different I'm calling it the chain of experience, right? All the links in the chain, you know, that have see all the links and see which ones are broken. And I clearly with Rappi, what you've done here is you found that broken link and we're able, you know, to identify that, oh, there's this temporal error that's happening, is control. It's very hard to test for, and we need a different solution other than, you know, the manual QA testing procedures that you see in most development teams. And so it's very interesting innovating in that edge, where it's something that, is obviously very much overlooked. It's a silent problem. You wouldn't even know that it's happening until actually you implement something. So we're moving into our second part of the conversation here. And we're thinking about the process and the outcome, what steps you took and what was that outcome. But perhaps let's open up with some thinking around the deep linking and the testing solution that you found in the marketplace.
Yeah. So obviously, like, you know, when you kind of think about testing you talk about, think about the traditional methods, right? Manual testing. You have like a couple of folks, and they would basically go through the workflows and they test these workflows, right? That's basically how we started. Like the MarTech team kind of time shared between us, and we were running through these workflows and we were trying to test it, and that quickly ran out of, like, you know, we ran out of bandwidth. There are only a few workflows you can test and so on. The next thing is the regression test suite. Like, you know, you like the product teams build, and they are like, you know, Selenium, and there are all these testing tools that are available to basically go and make sure that, like, you know, you would be able to automate tests, right? And here what needs to happen is it's like you're testing a UI. It's not just like you're testing a link, right? You're testing a UI in terms of like, this is the ad, this is where the click, the CTA is, call to action is, and you click on it, then you land here, and this is the expected experience. The problem, and the product teams do a great job of automating it and automating it at scale, but the problem here is the ads that are created and the creatives that are created, they are created at a much faster pace than your product, right? In a product, when you're actually going and doing all of these creative elements, it's not like the creative is changing all the time and so on and so forth. So if you really look at it from a product, from an ad perspective, that the way the creatives are changing is quite elaborate, right? So that normal whatever is available is normally what is available for product testing, that is not suitable for that. But it forms a base, like a product level testing. You can have some automation in here. Then so that's when we found this company called Mobo. What Mobo does is it is basically, we were searching for it, and we were like trying to then look at outsourced companies who are doing it and so on and so forth. And like, it was the thing, and we found Mobo. What Mobo does is use computer vision as a thing of looking at your app or image, and then trying to discern, like, you know, what parts of the of that particular object is valuable, right? And then, of course, then the more interesting part is they use robots. They actually have robots which would actually go, and you then go and imitate like a human, like clicking, right? Like obviously the only thing they have to do is the fingers, but it's like clicking and then like going through that whole process of going through that entire workflow. Because they use these two, they are able to kind of like run automation on very, very, like, you know, like a large set of these creatives, right? Like, if you produce a creative, all they have to do is to kind of like have their computer vision look at it, recognize, split that into models, into objects, and then the robot would basically identify, okay, I need to go click through this, and I need to make these five actions, and this is basically how it end the workflow. So they're able to kind of automate this at a lot faster than internal teams, of course, much better than manual QA.
It's fascinating, isn't it? Right. The way in which you're thinking about testing and automating that testing as much as possible, because with existing product testing, or, you know, the way we test most things, QAing emails or QAing, say, A/B tests on websites and things like that, you know, what are the limitations? Is it manual, in that you usually have a QA resource, a person doing that work, and in order then for deep linking, that's just you're dealing with what is that number, thousands, hundreds of thousands of unique experiences for users, you know, is that the problem? Is there just too much with human resources?
So right now we haven't even really explored Rappi, right? Like, in the sense of, in terms of these workflows. But today, across all of our, like, you know, just paid marketing, paid search, paid display and paid social workflows, like just the digital marketing workflows, we have about close to 367 workflows. Workflows, right? Like, these are basically, I like a Prime subscription. I have like different kinds of Prime subscriptions. So basically, if a user comes in and is unregistered, not even registered, then I have to kind of, like, you know, register, and then I have to land on the Prime subscription page and so on and so forth. And within Prime subscription, there are different value props that we basically go and produce, and each one of them will land in a different value prop page, right? Mm-hmm. And so each one of our business, Prime is like our, like Amazon Prime is like our subscription. Similarly, like, you know, Turbo is our quick service. So each one of these, right, we have like a large number of workflows first. Then I think that within these workflows, there are nuances, right? What actions the users, like if I offer a coupon, I don't offer a coupon. Like if I, like, you know, like there's so many variations that
yes.
you basically have to test. Now, do remember that I, as a marketeer, I focus on the ad and I focus on the creatives, but the minute it lands on the product, that is controlled by the product team, right? And they, it's a common workflow across a lot of other initiatives, right? Not all traffic on that particular, like a Pine subscription page, comes from marketing. It can be direct and it can be other things and so on and so forth. So that work page would change, and it might work on everything else, but I think the marketing use case might be drawn. And nobody, like, you know, if you look at the larger scheme of things, you don't test, like you just see the conversion rate going down for some specific thing, and you never come back and say, oh, you know what, there is this product change that happened in this small page, and that's where the conversion rate is going down. That is the foundational problem. The problem is this workflow starting from the ad onto the product, like, is not tested as rigorously as product workflows. Where product workflows, you have, like, you know, regression tests, you have stress tests, you have, like, all kinds of tests in there, right? But they're not testing the marketing workflows. None of them. None of these big companies, I can guarantee you, are testing the marketing workflows.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? Because you're right that there's sort of it's on both ends, isn't it? Because there's testing for the bare basics requirements for something to be shipped, right? Like, you know, does it work?
Correct.
Does the thing display as it's supposed to be in a test case? You know, there's all of that. But what you're explaining is that the marketing testing is also incredibly important, because that's not just usability or functionality testing. That's like, is this actually driving conversions? Is this the ideal experience? And you only really get to that through experimentation. And so you've got the both end, don't you? You go, okay, well, it's the usability and the functional testing in the QA is a test within the test, right? And for, as you say, you've got multiple campaigns, hundreds of workflows to test those things, but you also, as a marketer, want to optimize those things. And so perhaps before we get into how you actually use Mobo and their robots, talk me a little bit more about how that's set up, because you mentioned before that there's robots basically touching stuff on screens. What does that actually look like? Because it seems a little bit futuristic and maybe a little bit dystopian as well.
Yeah, I think they've got a lab set up, and this is basically how mobile apps are tested. As you know, like, you know, when you have, like, an Apple phone coming in, the Apple phone actually goes through, like, some kind of an automated testing to make sure all the basic features work before they hand it over to you, every phone, right? And it's not possible for me to kind of go through the whole sequencing and so on and so forth. So this is not like a new thing, except that now I think it's kind of like what this team has done is to kind of take that and then adopt it for a specific use case, right? So it's a lab where all these phones exist, and then the phones have, like, you know, like a computer vision thing set up, and it's got robots, like a small robot with just the hands, which is kind of going through that stuff. It is very futuristic to look at. For us, it doesn't make any difference. So what we do is we kind of lay out. So we had to build a whole integration in place. We had to lay down all the test cases, and we had to specify that these are the testing workflows that we have. We had to send it to them. They consumed it, and then they would run the test case, and then produce a report, and they'll directly file Jira tickets onto our system, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so if they find a problem, they'll find a Jira ticket in the system, and that Jira ticket will be directed to the product and engineering with all, like, so what happens is they have a complete screen recording from start to finish on, like, you know, every step would be recorded. Like, you know, every step would basically say, this is how I came to that, these are the actions I did, and then I did this, I expected this, this is what happened, but this is basically what, like, the thing. So the entire documentation of the test and so on and so forth, and they'll find the Jira ticket, and then we'll follow up with the product and engineering team to go and fix it. More importantly, what it helps us, one is like, you know, we, like, if there are critical campaigns that are running and we know that this product flows workflow is broken, then we can actually go and pause these campaigns. We can be proactive in pausing these campaigns and redirecting that budget somewhere else, right? Otherwise, there'll be silent failures and we wouldn't know it and so on. And so we'd be losing money and we'd be the typically what a marketer does is to kind of worry about all of the things. Are we spending enough? Is the creative good? And so on and so forth. And they would never understand that probably the product workflow is broken. And so this dimension also, this information will also be provided.
Mm. So if I understand you correctly, it's literally a massive, almost like a farm of all the different devices, all their different shapes and sizes, a different OS. And there's literally robotic fingers pushing. So you give them the test case, the AI will interpret the test case into steps, and then it will actually go through it, touching a real device and using computer vision to identify the pass fail on all of those tests. And so I can imagine just this huge factory of, you know, thousands and thousands of robot arms doing these test cases. And that sounds very interesting. I think the first thing that's interesting is that a lot of automated testing is usually virtual. So you're just running it on basically emulators, right, of existing devices and browsers and screen sizes and things like that. So there's that kind of emulator aspect to it, which doesn't really get to the real device, like the physical device and the experience of that actual device and the screen and the resolution and all the other things, right? Because different screens have different resolutions and colors and all those. But I can imagine it's probably also terribly expensive to have, you know, thousands of robots with little fingers picking at things all day long. You know, it's a very interesting way of thinking about QA and testing from that perspective. But did I get that right? Because, I mean, I'm curious because that seems to be like a very...
No, that's absolutely right. Yeah. But think about it. Like, so I was an engineer before, and before I came into marketing, I never thought about the cost, right? Like it was always a good solution and how good the solution is. Unfortunately, after marketing, I have to worry about my ROI, ROAS, and so on and so forth. So we did that analysis, and that was one of the main reasons of how we pushed it. We did a ROI analysis. And we found out that the cost for the solution is like 5K, but we would be able to kind of get about 150K incremental orders because of it. And the way we came at this thing is we did a pilot. We ran a pilot for about a month. And we found that 50% of our deep links actually failed in different points of time. 50% of our deep links. And then and then we kind of took a huge haircut from there. We basically said, okay, 50% is failing. Let me kind of take, like, bring it down a lot, and then, like, say 10% of it. And then that 10%, if I can identify these and fix it and make sure the conversion rate is there, and then I also, like, redirect the spend to the one that's working and so on and so forth, we can actually go and generate 150K incremental orders. So by spending 5K, I'm getting 150K incremental orders, which means the cost per incremental delivery was 3 cents per delivery.
That analysis of knowing how many of your deep links fail, and then the solution, as you say, 5K for 150K return purely by, as you say, the effort of knowing what's broken and then being able to quickly shift ad spend to different campaigns while that problem is being solved, you know, and also having the confidence that what is in market is actually is usable and tests passes quality, you know. So that's fascinating, and that, you know, that as a you know, you'll look at QA not as a way to grow a business. You know, that's a really interesting thing here, in that QA is usually just the last step. Like, it's like, we've got the use case, we want to do the thing, and we want to make this much money from this specific use case. And the QA is just the functional step at the end before it goes out to market. But what you've been able to do is turn that functional step into a way to drive revenue and growth for the business.
Yeah. Yeah, and maybe like this is probably our initial, obviously, like as we find these problems and fix it, maybe we wouldn't have so many failures and so on and so forth. But I always think of QA as an insurance more than anything else. Why do you take insurance? Not because accidents happen. You know, like you want to be protected when accidents happen, right? So I think the thing is, I think the cost, to your point of expense, at least right now, from our point of view, It is just like the cost of it, of providing an automated solution across all of these workflows seems to be so inexpensive. It's like even like I can basically go take this and like multiply this like 4 or 5 times and it would still be more. Like, you know, I can pay like 25, like whatever, 25K, and it's still be like, you know, viable for us. And even if the number of failures come down, right? Just as an insurance, like, you know, because our spend is like 100 million, $200 million, and then spending 20K to make sure that like the QA is fine, the products are fine, it's like good. And if you, and this is an answer, I've been talking to a lot of CMOs and the answer is always zero. Like I've been asking them, okay, how much time do you spend on QA? And it's like zero. The product and product team is doing it. And I keep telling them that the product team is not QAing your stuff. You're doing some manual QA, but yep. You're not. They are working on it and so on and so forth. So it's fascinating for me that with that large spends, the amount of money that's spent on QA is very minimal, right? And but on the product side, the QA, the spend on QA is significant, right? It's like it's a reasonable amount of your budget. But not on the marketing team. And that seems weird.
And you also mentioned that there's probably some cost savings in the automation, not in the actual QA, but also in the data that's sent back from those tests. Because you mentioned earlier that you have it integrated with Jira. And so when there is an error or an issue, a ticket is raised.
Correct.
That's integrated into the technology platform as well, that ability for them to provide that feedback in an automated way.
Exactly. So the whole, every interaction is recorded, right? The whole session is recorded. And the minute it identifies a failure, it takes that recording, creates a Jitter ticket and puts it and it assigns it to the team, right? And then there's like, so it makes the whole process a lot more simpler. Can you imagine? Like, I mean, yes, I mean, you can have automated tests, but a human being doing it, like, you know, doing that repeatedly and so on and so forth. This is like in my opinion, if I really, hindsight 2020, this problem is set up for a robot, right? Who can do this job repeatedly, get the test case, run through the steps and record it. If there is a problem, file a Jira ticket, attach this and move on, right? And keep doing that over a period of time. And then they have got these rules, lots of rules set up in here. So one thing is they have a library, that's where all the AI comes in. So let's say the bug is already seen or there was already a like a similar problem reported. So they don't report multiple problems, like multiple Jira tickets for the same problem. They kind of identify similar problems, group them together, identify it in the pure Jira and all that. And you, like all this is like, you know, there is some kind of like a AI involved in figuring out, okay, what are the similar tests and similar failures and then grouping those failures together and then taking them and assigning it to the common problem and so on and so forth. So multiple places where like a human, or if you're really writing a rule-driven workflow, it's a lot harder to do than this whole thing being taken over by AI.
Yeah, there's a lot of advantages there. And there's also, there's a lot of trust placed in those technologies as well, isn't there?
Of course, knowing that
a real flesh and blood human has literally gone through all the steps with their own devices is very different from an AI system. However, at the scale in which you're operating, there is just no, like there's literally impossible to get that kind of scale with actual humans, unless you wanted to hire thousands and thousands of people to do it every single day. You know, that's just,
absolutely,
it's never going to happen. You know, even, you know, yeah, most big tech platforms, they don't get moderation right because they just can't hire enough people to do it, you know, and it's it's very cheap labor as well, right? So it's very interesting thinking about the role of AI in something that is actually extremely critical to a business, which is the customer's experience on a marketplace app. You know, what else can be more important to a company? And allowing an AI or trusting that AI to give you assurance that everything is to standard is a massive leap of trust. So I just want to say thank you for making that leap of trust and congratulations, because gosh, it's most marketers would bristle at that. So moving on. So you've got this technology, you've been able to reduce your costs, but also use it as an opportunity to drive revenue and growth. What was the hardest part of onboarding and using these technologies?
It's this whole integration, right? Like, so the point is, like, from an ad, how do I basically go and specify an ad workflow to them so that, like, you know, they would understand like how to kind of take that and then like generalize it? And you know that the the ad workflows change quite a bit. Like, for example, like our creatives, right? Like our creator refreshes, like, you know, we refresh our creatives a lot during the year and so forth. So they're new creatives, new creative workflows that come quite often. And the company that was doing was actually product testing, and it was not really a marketing use case. So we had to kind of somehow like get that integration done. We were specifying these creative workflows, and then we are refreshing these creative workflows, and we are pushing it and so on and so forth, right? So they had to change some process and so on and so forth. That was one problem of taking our marketing workflow, making that available to them. But the bigger problem was internal, right? Like internally, like kind of like, you know, justifying this whole aspect of product being broken and how do I kind of bring it to the workflow and so on and so forth. We had a lot of false positive initially. This is again a lesson learned from me, like, you know, how to kind of, when to kind of like bring this in and so on and so forth, show excitement. Initially there was a lot of positive. Like we'd find out an error because all of us are learning from the thing, we're doing at the scale, like we found, like, you know, whatever, like there are 100 failures, then you kind of look at it, of them, the 40 failures are not really the like good failures, right? Like they were all like things which were like happened just because the configuration was incorrect or something was happening. The product was out of stock, which is an expected failure and so on and so forth, right? There are a lot of reasons why those workflows fail and so on. So to kind of get the team, the marketing team kind of in, on this by, like, you know, continuing to persist, work with them, start showing some real values. And then we started getting some real bugs out of it. Like we really started getting something like foundational problems that we were missing. There was a parameter which was not getting passed, and therefore certain type of campaigns at certain parts of the day were not getting tracked. Right, we would have never found it if we didn't go through this kind of a scale. Then when we started examining, because it kind of does a very deep analysis, it's, oh, this parameter is not passed. It's like, okay, what would have happened? Why is this? Then we went back and it's like, why didn't we find it before? And that there was this drop in conversion rate for those specific set of campaigns under these conditions. So once we started getting these kind of examples, then the paid marketing team kind of, like, you know, started putting their wood behind us. They're saying, yeah, it was good and so on. And now they are the biggest champions for us. And it's actually coming out of the first time, this is the tool, but it's coming out of the marketing budget. It's coming out of the media budget. So the testing.
Oh, wow. Okay. Fascinating.
For a growth marketer to sacrifice their media dollars means that it is valuable, right? Like, you know, it's like they protect that like nothing.
But because it's both the technical part and marketing needs are met with this solution, was it a challenge to figure out where it should sit in the business from a budget perspective and who should operate it and those things? Because I can imagine that.
We haven't gotten there. We are still in the honeymoon phase right now. We are kind of like getting. We are in the initial. Like we are finding good things out of this, right? Like, so, I was able to kind of like put the solution in place. We were able to kind of like get paid marketing on our side, and we are able to convince them. And so right now it sits from the media dollars. But I agree with you. I think long term, we might get into a point where usually the infrastructure budget sits with the product teams, right, and the CIO organization. For now, it actually sits within marketing.
Yeah,
it was actually funded by marketing.
Incredible. That's pretty unique to have that kind of level of technological sophistication funded by marketing. It's very interesting. So my next question is, so how much of the challenge was impacted by things like coordinating people, processes, technology use? What do you think was the most impactful way to solve the problem? Was it aligning everyone and just getting everyone on the same page? Was it actually just using the tech? Was it the strategy and the buy-in from leadership? Which thing was the most impactful, do you think, to actually you getting to the solution and having it in market?
So I'm going to, I think all of them were problems. This is not an easy problem to kind of.
Yeah.
The biggest problem is actually, I think, getting the executive buy-in, right? Like, because this was unprecedented. This is not something that we had actually done it. And so unfortunately, I couldn't just push it through, and we had to kind of make sure the executive buy-in is happening. And that had to go on a gradual process. We had to first basically build the technology. Then we had to get paid marketing to come in, and they become the champions of it. And then, like, you know, kind of then go and forward this to the executive team, and they were like, okay, fine. Like, you know, because we had so much support and because we had so much proof points, they were able to kind of buy in, but it was like a longer road, right? So normally, like right now, it's all about value. 20, like as opposed to like 2 years back, it was all about growth. Now it's like, you know, like money is kind of like hard to come by, so you have to really justify every investment. So things like this, when I say buzzwords like computer vision, robots, and all that, immediately the thought that comes into it is expensive. Don't do it. Like, great idea, expensive, don't do it. Like, just like use people to do it. Like, come on, there must be cheaper ways to find it. Like, it's like just the thing. So kind of like trying to overcome that sentiment with the executives was the hardest thing.
Because I can imagine for you walking into the leadership team and saying, hey, we want to use our budget on a QA tool. And their first question is, how's that going to make us money, right? Like, there is a lot of education in that, I can imagine.
Correct, 100%.
How does a technical QA tool result in, as you said, right, 5,000 investment for $150,000 return? How does that, you know, so I can imagine you having to educate and actually spend a lot of time thinking through it. You know, would have been a massive part of the work here, just to get sign off and approval to do the work as well.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
And this is something that I'm noticing more and more with all of the MarTech projects, right? Like, to be very to put the outcome, like start stating what the outcome is, and make it in terms of the business outcomes, right? Like, translate it to what it means for them, and then some of these projects become a lot easier.
Definitely. Once you have that alignment and that buy-in, then you can start moving and working on the process. So I want to ask you, before I ask for a couple reflections, is, you know, throughout this entire process, was there a moment that was really painful? And why was it painful?
It was like, you know, as we were trying to basically go bring the solution on board, right? Like, and we were trying to basically go and like, I saw the light of the solution. We did the manual process and we knew that it was not there, you know. And then I contacted Bobo. We were trying to work through the process. And this is true for every MarTech initiator. Mm. Unfortunately, the projects are not like this, right? Like, you don't put an infrastructure solution like fast. It takes some time for you to invest, and you have to kind of like make sure you put in some money. Initially, you invest some money, invest some resources, and then the results will take some time to happen. So that initial period is like a very, very tough, was a very tough period on this, right? We had, like I said, like, you know, we put in the infrastructure. First of all, the infrastructure was taking time. We didn't have that much support internally. There was some internal stuff that needed to happen. There was like, obviously not for any other reason. It's just that all the resources were prioritized for other projects, right? So we had to beg, borrow, and steal to basically go and make that asks of like opening up this database connection, doing this thing, and like setting up the permissions and so on. Simple task, but took a long time. And then after, like, you know, then what happens is like a couple of weeks later, 3 weeks later, it's like nothing is happening, right? Because the whole thing is getting set up. So then it's like, oh, it's taking a little bit more time. Because in marketing, everything happens really fast. It's not like solutions, like kind of like in general, like, you know, when you're launching campaigns and all that. So, but the technology, like, you know, you have to get used to it. So that initial part, until we were able to show value, that was like a very painful time. Painful.
Well, yes. Because it is, I can imagine it's painful because of the level of unknowns, you know, and there's so many unknowns, as you say, the technology implementation unknown, the veracity or the quality of the outcome unknown, the even idea of using robots to touch, you know, smartphone screens and whatnot, unknown, you know, that whole, there's a lot of sort of new terrain. And then chuck into that, you're not in tech specifically, you're in the marketing tech team, which is marketing focused. So you, there's that, everyone is perhaps fairly new to QA as well, you know, so there's a lot of sort of unknowns there trying to tackle. But I appreciate you sharing that, because it's good to sort of know what was the most, the challenging time, which kind of leads us to our last question here, which is, well, what advice do you have for folks that are looking to sort of scale up their QA efforts and get to this sort of level of really sophisticated use of AI and machine learning and, you know, and computer vision to scale up and actually turn QA not just into a cost center, but a revenue and a growth center? What's your advice for folks trying to tackle something similar?
So my point is, when you're tackling something similar, start, and this is a common advice that I have for all MarTech projects, is to start with the outcome first, which I think I should have. If I talked about a CPID of 0.3 cents, I think there will be a huge excitement. And I think that kind of like value roadmap that you kind of put in, and you kind of like take your thing and kind of derive that value. Which is why MarTech folks are a little special, right? Like we are a cross between a technology professional, marketing professional, but we also like, you know, like in that sense, we are the bridge. And so we have to talk like in business terms, right? We have to go to marketing people and talk technology, but in terms of business. So having that value, I feel like, you know, like leading with that, and then like showing that would be good. Also, please understand that this is basically going to be a slightly longer term process. So kind of set that expectations. Like just kind of say that, oh, it's going to take like a 2 months to 3 months before like, you know, you start seeing results, which is not very, I mean, it is common and not so common within marketing. So it's kind of setting expectations of when you see the value realization is going to be important.
So, leading with the outcome and the overall thing you're looking to achieve, creating that vision for that, so you can get support and people are excited, you know, to actually work on it and bring everyone together, and then staying focused on that, you know, all the way throughout the process, setting the expectations to know, you know, this may take 6 months to implement or 12 months to implement, you know, and continue to set those expectations and update those expectations as you go down the path. Would that sound about right? Yep. Well, now you're working on this program, you're starting to see some outcomes. What does the future hold for the app and web experience at Rappi? What else are you working on, or what do you anticipate how this program may evolve into the future?
So in general, I mean, this is part of the bigger landscape that the bigger platform that we're working on. One of the things is, when I'm preaching to the choir here, retail media is like a big deal, right? Like it's kind of a big deal, and there is no, it's there is some hype, obviously hype on it, but on the other hand, like Rappi is sitting on rich first party data, right? Which was not available to people before. We understand what people's behaviors are. We are a very data-driven company, and so we've got all kinds of statistics available about the user, and that is something that I think other, not just Rappi, but other merchants can use to make intelligent decisions about their business, on growing their business and so on and so forth, right? So making that data available so that the broader community can benefit is like is a big deal, right? Like, and I do see that, for me, data-driven marketing is all about bringing efficiency so that we can divert these funds to more important things, right? Like rather than spending time on like, you know, wasting money and time on marketing. That's how I see it. And so retail media is a huge, it's like a huge gold mine. So the growth machine that we are building today, we are building it for Rappi. But the idea is to then, once we build this growth machine, of which the testing is a part, we have like a creative platform, we have like a measurement platform, we have like a, so we have like all of these, an audience platform, all of them working in conjunction. Once we figure out how to kind of like do this very efficiently, then have other businesses use this machine to kind of drive efficiency and growth within their businesses. And I do believe that's where we are getting to. I've been in MarTech for the past 14 years. So it's like, you know, like sometimes people tell me, okay, like, you know, like You've said this before, in 10, 15 years back, you're saying exactly the same thing. So come on, like 15 years, what is, why are we working on the same thing again and again? I do believe that there are some things which kind of help, there are some things which kind of is a reason why right now is a better time for us to kind of build it. One is composability. You talk about it. Scott Brinker talks about, like, lots of people talk about composability as a first-class object, and that's becoming more and more real, right, with infrastructures right now. I do see that you can actually build a very sophisticated MarTech stack, very sophisticated MarTech stack, like using internal resources as well as buying, so that you can kind of find a holistic solution, right? It's no longer there is this one solution I need to get to. And okay, they are good at one, but they're not good at 10. But unfortunately, I need to buy that one solution, right? Like, you can build that solution right now. So that is great. And then the prevalence of AI, right? Like, it's for whatever reason, the last few years, AI solutions are easier to build, easier to deploy. There's lot more solutions in place, and so on. So all of this is making a better MarTech stack. Like, the ability to build a better MarTech stack today. So we're using all of those constructs to build that growth machine in Rappi.
Yeah, well, that's fantastic. Satya, this has been absolutely fascinating conversation about what is a very unique application of both AI and testing and QA. A lot of folks look at QA as just a necessary part of doing business. However, what you've been able to establish with us through our case study is that QA is a significant part of growth as well. And so, Satya, I really appreciate the openness and thank you so much for your time.
Absolutely. It's been such a pleasure, and I'm a huge fan of the MarTech Weekly. I'm glad that you guys are doing it. So I really appreciate it.
Fantastic. Thank
And
you.
I really appreciate this interaction. I learn a lot. Every time I talk to you, I learn a lot. So I really appreciate it.
I appreciate that. Thank you.